Well, I had here, I had 184 acres on this farm. And then I had 100 acres up on the mountain pasture that I used to, we used to drive our cattle up there in the summertime, dry cattle as well as young cattle. And that was right up on the mountain here on the, between Waitsfield and Northfield. And it was almost to the top of the mountain. And we used to drive them up there in the spring of the year. We always had a hell of a time getting them up there because after the cattle been in the barn, you know, they're pretty frolicky. And my brother and I, we used to have to chase the cattle all around to try to keep them straight. And usually by the time we got them about to the foot of the mountain, they were ready to want to lay down. And of course you couldn't, you didn't want to have an animal lie down because it had to be pretty hard for them that you couldn't get them up. So we'd have to sometimes be rather a little bit strict with them and drive them and keep them moving. And then we'd get them up there. And then in the fall of the year, we'd go up and pick them up and bring them back down. And so we could barn them, you know, for the winter. And then later on, I sold that 100 acres up there to my brother. And originally, that was originally one of the first Wallace property.
Yeah, it was, when your grandfather first bought this farm, how big was it then?
He had sheep.
Uh-huh.
He had sheep. He raised sheep until Australia took over the market. And then, of course, the sheep market went all to pieces.
And that was, what, about 1880?
My father had, when he took over the farm, he had some sheep and a few cows. Then he changed it over to dairy. I guess at that time he had some Jersey, mostly Jersey cows. Then later he went into Holsteins. One day I was in the town clerk's office and I was going through some of the records up there. And I found, come on, the records of the tattoos of the different families. Evidently, as near as I could figure, I think most of them kind of put their flocks together, and each one, of course, had their tattoo on the each animal. And I imagine in the spring of the year or fall of the year, they would subdivide them and shear the sheep and that sort of thing. But you'll find up in the town records why the different families have had different tattoos. It's quite interesting to see the different tattoos. And
so your grandfather had merino sheep then.
Mm-hmm.
And he, what, 150 or something, large?
I don't know. I never knew how many sheep he did have. I know my father got awfully fed up with it because he said when it come lambing time, they had to bring in the lambs and they'd put them behind the stove to keep them warm and so on. And the next thing was to get the mother sheep to own the sheep again.
Yeah, we went through all that.
And they, I guess he got pretty well fed up with it, and that's why he went into dairy. And of course, years ago, of course, people had, most of them had just a few animals, a few cows, and they would make their own butter. And of course, that was before the day they had creameries. And they would usually during the winter time they'd store the butter down cellar, and then in the spring of the year they'd sell it, go up to the city and sell it, or it'd be shipped off to the bigger cities. I remember my father telling one time that he had a whole bunch of butter down in the cellar, and a skunk got down there. And he was puzzled. He didn't know just what to do. And finally, the hired man, I guess, suggested, he said, why don't you get a barrel, and we'll have one end open, and we'll put the barrel down there. So that's what they did. They put the barrel down there, and they went down and just gradually tried to coax the skunk into the barrel. They got the skunk into the barrel, and then they put a cover on it immediately over the barrel and lugged the barrel and the skunk outdoors. And then when they got outdoors, they just let the skunk go. But at that time, he said I had all my winter supply of butter in there. And he said, of course, you can imagine if that skunk ever let go, what would happen to the butter. So, so well, it's hard. You know, I tell some of the new people that come here, I said, I can remember when the grass used to grow up here in the center of the road. And it's kind of hard for them to believe that. I think the new road, the Otavia Road, was put through, I think, around 1940, I think, somewhere in there. And it was a blessing when they did, because the roads would get so washboardy, and the dust would fly, and of course then we'd begin to have more cars, and all that dirt during the summer would, and the wind would take it and just fly it over onto the fields of hay and the grass. And it was almost impossible to sell a cow, because after you milked a cow for 2 or 3 years and you fed them that hay with all that dust on it, the teeth, it would grind the teeth down. And a lot of people would think when they come to buy a dairy cow, well, that must be an old cow, which it wasn't. And, but I can remember at that time that wind would take that stuff and just blow it right over and just waves over onto the field. And it was awfully dirty and dusty for haying. So I was very glad when the tar road went through.
What about flooding and so forth before the dams and stuff? Was there a lot more flooding, or did?
Well, of course, we had the 27 flood.
Do you remember?
Oh, yes. I remember the 27 flood very well. Very well. It did a tremendous amount of damage here in Vermont. It took out most all the bridges. In fact, the culvert out here where my brook is, it took that out. It took out about 30 to 40 feet of the road. And if due to the fact that we had so much rain, that a lot of the twigs and, you know, some logs and things come down the brook and block the culvert. Well, there's a regular leak out back there. And finally, the road let go, and it took everything right out, you see. And I think old Dr. Shaw was the last one that went across that on the road. And he went across just before that thing went out. He had his old horse and buggy. Of course, those days, the doctor used to go around to their patients. And they had their horse and buggies, and they went around and delivered babies and things like that. And lots of times, the doctor would get some money, and a lot of the times he'd get commodities, like potatoes, vegetables, and that sort of thing, to pay him. And I can remember old Dr. Shaw up here. He was very good on medicine, very good, but a damn poor man when it comes for surgical or anything like that, because he was kind of dirty. He wasn't too careful with his instruments. And I remember going into the office one day up there. In fact, I had been working up in the woods, and something happened. So this was on a Sunday, and I went up to see old Dr. Shaw. And he was examining me for a hernia, which I had. And he was punching me and so on and so forth, and I was standing up. And all of a sudden, I went black, and I fell right over and went right into a chair. Old Dr. Shaw, and the first thing I know, he was waving some spirits of ammonia under my nose. I kind of come to. God, he says, I don't think you slept well last night. So, anyway, ended up that I did have a hernia. So, but anyway, I can remember going to his office, and he had shelves, and he had big jars of pills, different kinds of pills, and, you know, things for medicine that was in them. And if you wanted any pills or anything, he'd dole out some pills and hand them to you. You didn't have to go to a drugstore or anything like that. In fact, we didn't have a drugstore around here. And but The doctors were very, very good. If you called on them, boy, they would be here. That's different as today. If you have something ill, you've got to take the ambulance or go to the hospital, because the doctor doesn't make local calls. I guess very rare, but I guess once in a while they do if they have to, an emergency, but it's very rare.
How about home remedies? There was a lot more of that, and many of them were very good.
That's right. Well, a lot of them come from the Indians. The Indians had a lot of home remedies. In fact, penicillin was one. I don't know what the herb was that had the penicillin, but there was something in it. I don't think the Indians knew what it was, but they knew that it helped them. So I think you find a lot of those remedies come from Indians. They were picked up by the native people. And you take the Iroquois Indians. They were the first really democratic government. In fact, I've heard that Benjamin Franklin got a lot of his ideas from the Iroquois Indians on how they performed their government.
You were talking about Doc Shaw coming across the bridge just before the
27 flood.
In the 27 flood. Can you tell me a little bit more about what it was like right here? Did the river, it must have been a raging torrent.
It was. It was flooded right up, up to the road here.
Mm-hmm.
All the meadows were flooded quite deep. And up on the flat up there, just south of Waitsville, north of Waitsville Village, that was all flooded. In fact, when I remember the next day when I went to high school, I had to walk to high school. I was walking through mud pretty near up to my knees. I think they closed the school for a short time, but after the water had subsided, that whole flat was just nothing but mud. You wouldn't know hardly where the road was.
And you weren't worried about this house, though?
No. There was, up there in the village, they were quite worried about that because the water did come down into the village there, and it was very rapid. I think it did move some of the buildings a little bit, but not very much. It took out most all the bridges down through here, if you had to get over here to the other side, you either had to go around like down here to Marttown and then go around that way. And in fact, right after the flood, my father had to go down to Boston, and the only way he could get down to Boston, he had to go over the hills to get there. He had quite a time getting down there and getting back, because he was on some milk business of some kind for the Corps. And it was a year or two there. It was very difficult because of the road conditions. And of course, over there at Waterbury, of course, it did a tremendous amount of damage there. In fact, a lot of people lost their lives, because I've heard of stories where a person told me that they'd see a house going down the river and there would be a light on it, and then of course when they went over the Bolton Dam down there where the park was, well then that destroyed the house, and usually they drowned themselves. So there was quite a lot of people that went down in the flood. And then of course they had that school there, and that took out quite a lot of the children too, a lot of children.
What school?
Yeah, that was around Bolton. In Bolton there. I think there was quite a few that lost their lives there. It was a very unusual storm. I can remember my father was up at the schoolhouse because he was the school director, and my mother called him up and told him, she says, I think, George, you better get back home, because she says, I don't think you're going to get back home if you don't. And so immediately he unleashed the horse. He had a wagon at that time, and he got home just in time before the culvert went out. Everything really was a mess, like any other flood when anything happens like that.
Well, I've seen a lot of photographs.
Yeah. Well, it took out, of course, the railroad tracks. It took out everything up through here. Yeah.
The other thing I'm interested in is many farmers did other things like logging in the winter and to bring in, you know, some extra cash. And I wondered, did you focus pretty much on farming, or would you occasionally take a load of logs to the mill, or?
That's right, we did.
To the Ward Mill, or?
No, usually it was a mill up here, and there used to be a mill down below here, down near where Albert Turner. It was a mill down there that was run by Mr. Seaver, and he used to saw out lumber for, you know, for the farmers, for their own use, as well as sell some lumber from that. Yeah, at one time, there was a lot of mills up through the valley here. I think there was three or four mills here in Wakefield, and I think at one time there used to be about six or seven up there in Warren. And, of course, what they'd do in the wintertime, they would cut the logs, of course, in the fall, and then they would haul them down, and they'd start stacking them up in the yards before the mud season. And, of course, most all the mills had big log yards that they would store. And then during the spring, when there was high water, which would run, you know, the turbines or something for the power, they would saw out the lumber, you see. And I can remember years ago when I was a kid, I used to sleep up in this room up here, and I can remember that Ward's teams, there'd be anywhere, well, probably 10 or 15 of them. And I can remember they would go up by here about 4 o'clock in the morning in the winter time, and I would listen to them, and each one had a different sounding bell. And you'd hear this ding-dong, ding-dong, and then the next one would be another different tone on the bell going up by. So actually you could tell, well, who's going up by here. And most everybody knew everybody in the valley, and knew their names and that sort of thing, which now I don't think I even know 1% or even less than that of the people here. But I can remember at 4 o'clock in the morning seeing those teams go up by, hearing them. And of course those days we had what the old call the old feather bed mattresses. And my mother was always one to take up the mattress and fluff it all up. And when I was a kid, I used to run and jump into the bed, and all the you'd settle right down in there. You were nice and cozy in those goose feather beds. And but I can remember those cold, cold mornings. I would say, "There, oh boy, how lucky I am." Then it usually about 4 or 5 o'clock at night. You'd see those loggers come down with a load of logs. And then, of course, they would unload their logs at the mill, and then they'd have to put up their horses and be ready for the next morning to start out. And most of the logs were coming up in Faiston, North Faiston, and Center Faiston, and South Faiston, and some here in Wakefield. So it was a hard life, but a good life.
Yeah, you hear that over and over. Those loads must have been big loads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would. And in the spring of the year, of course, sometimes the hills, you know, got melted off, the snow would, and they'd have to team up. In other words, if they were in a line, why, the first fellow that had to go up the hill, the others would take their team off and hitch on ahead and pull them up the hill. And then they'd all come back and take the next one, wherever the ground got down where there wasn't any snow on it. And usually, especially those the hills that were on the south side, you see, where the sun could get at. Because that was always the first for the snow to go. And they used to haul logs right up just as long as they possibly could, you know. And of course, it was easier to put logs on a sled than it was to be on a wagon.
Here on the farm, what did you, you had cattle,
mm-hmm.
and or cows, and you grew hay,
mm-hmm.
and did you grow corn, potatoes?
Oh yes, we raised some potatoes. Father used to put in an acre or two of potatoes, and then he'd take them out to Montpelier and sell them. I used to have to pick over potatoes in the winter time, sprout them and that sort of thing. Get them ready for market. Of course, there was a while after my father took over the farm, he raised hogs. And then usually butchered. And remember, we used to have a track out here front of the garage, and the hogs would hang there for maybe 24 hours or something like that. And then when it come night, he would get the wagon out and put the hogs, you know, and the meat on the wagon and cover it all up and start for Montpelier. And he'd get out there. He'd get out there to Montpelier. This was during the summertime, of course. And he'd get out there in Montpelier and deliver his hogs around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and then come back home. And the reason for that, they did it at night because of the temperature, you see, because it got too warm during the day.
So he would butcher probably in the late fall of the year?
Yeah, that's right.
How many hogs did he...
I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you.
Did he have ducks and geese and...
No, we had hens. We didn't have very many. Just mostly for our own use. Maybe, if you had a few dozen left, we always took them up to the store up here and sell them, you know, or trade them in for groceries. Of course, those old days, the grocery stores, they always had a, you had boxes of cookies. I can remember the boxes would be about that square. And you'd go in and help yourself, put them in the bags, and they'd weigh it up, and that was it. And you'd buy the flour, or you'd buy your sugar. Most all of that stuff was just the essentials that you really would buy, because most of the vegetables and things you always raised yourself. And it was, and it had flour come in barrels, or the sugar would come barreled, and they would just simply scoop it out and put it into a bag. And if you had coffee, well, you always, they'd grind the coffee right there and put it through the one of those big wheel grinders, and you'd get, have some coffee. But as I say, most of it was like essentials like sugar and flour and oatmeal. But they were all mostly in bulk. Of course, it's a lot different today, and because nowadays they put it in a box and they put a paper in there, and then they have to have another paper, and by the time you get through it, most of it's paper that you buy. But I don't know, maybe it wasn't as sanitary, I don't know. Although I don't know if anybody had any more bugs those days than they have now.
You could get into it a lot easier, you know.
That's right. That is right. And of course, as far as entertainment, we all had our entertainment. They'd usually have plays, and they had dances maybe once a week or once in 2 weeks, the old-fashioned dances and maybe some of the modern dances. And everybody went to them, old and young, and we had our good times.
You used to have them here?
What do you mean?
I've heard.
Oh, you mean kitchen junkets?
Like kitchen junkets and.
No, we never. Father, mother never believed in them here in the house. I've been to some of the old kitchen junkets. The only trouble is there that sometimes the liquor got to flowing pretty heavy. But my father, mother kind of looked down on those things. They thought they were kind of rude. So if I ever went to one, they never knew it.
One of the things that has interested me too is the changeover from, you know, gradually the tractors came in and a lot of people had horses along with tractors and then gradually made the switch over. And I know you said when you took over the farm you had two or three horses. How about making that switch over? And you said you were talking about oxen and sugaring, and I've heard about the difference, how the oxen plodded through the snow and the horses.
That's right.
But at the same time, you could, the horses knew every tree to stop at and then would bring the load back to the barn, to the sugar house without a word.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, I used to like to drive oxen. They were really wonderful in the woods for logging, that sort of thing, because you didn't have a lot of whipple trees and things like that to deal with. And usually oxen were one that, well, they were slow, and lots of time you take a pair of horses. If you've got a good pair of horses where they would really get right down into it and do steady, which is rather rare. Most of them, lots of times, they'd get down in and then they'd begin to jump around, they'd go back and forth like this. Oxen wasn't that way. They would just really get right down into it and really pull and put the effort into it. They were slow, but I always loved them. They were always gentle. Very good, and they were very good in snow. And most everybody had oxen those days, rather than horses for hauling, sort of thing. Except for loggers that were, you know, driving back and forth or something like that, of course.
Well, did you use oxen for sugaring?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So how late did you, when did you begin to really switch over all to machinery?
Oh, about the same time when I took over the farm, right in about 1936, I would say. I didn't have a tractor until probably 1940 or something like that. I couldn't afford one, and I was always one, and I was always brought up. My father brought me up, don't buy anything unless you can pay for it. And this is one reason, I think, why so many farmers in those days stayed in business, because they were conservative, and if they figured they didn't have the money, they just didn't buy it. I think that's half the problem today with the farmers. When times are good, I think they go out and they buy a lot of machinery equipment, which is very expensive, and then they get themselves into a bind, and then they lose everything. It was a little different attitude in those days. Everything, as I say, more or less was done with a handshake and that sort of thing. You made deals with your neighbors and so on, and you did it with a handshake, and everybody lived up their obligations. But today, of course, you've got to have everything written out, and you've got to have it tighter than a bark to a tree. Otherwise, you just lose out.
And those changes really
You probably had that same thing over there in your New Hampshire.
Absolutely, absolutely. But here, it seems like the start of most of that was the development of the ski industry in this valley. Is that, would you say that was?
Yeah, it really, the big change was starting about 1950. I think some of the people that come up here, the first ones that come up here, like Alan Clark and the Williams and Henry Perkins and some of them, I think they come up here and they thought Vermont was a wonderful place, and they really joined in with the Vermonters and took more or less the Vermonters' ways. And I think in about 10 years after that, when we got another influx of people coming up here, then that's when the thing began to change with all regulations and that sort of thing. As I told Alan Clark one day, if I mentioned his name, I saw him up at the shopping center one day, and of course he's bidding on this project with my niece here, and we were talking about it. And God, he says, there's so much regulations down. He says, it's a lot different than it used to be. I says, yes, it is, Alan. And he was feeling that, beginning to feel like, you know, like the rest of us, you know, we Vermonters. I says, Alan, I says, you're not a Vermonter, but I says, you're beginning to think like a Vermonter. And he kind of laughed.